then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, O O'Farrell, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the banshee's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's April the 25th, 2013. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Now, the first comment I want to make on this episode is regarding a rather historic event that took place this week, although it will have to remain pretty much unsung for a time. I want to extend my thanks to a group of young men in Oregon who carried out a certain Northwest independence activity over the weekend. Now, the thing is, they did this acting on their own, without any reference to me, and without asking either my permission or demanding my personal participation, leading the charge on my white horse with my saber flourished aloft and my cape flying in the wind. I don't want to get into detail about this perfectly legal political action because I don't want to set the secret police on these guys' trail. They do not appear to have been identified and cataloged yet, and there is a reasonable hope that these guys are not yet on that massive database in West Virginia. And if not, I don't want it to be me who outs them. And also because we will want to do this again. Now, I always figured that one of the signs that things were beginning would be when people started doing things on their own, without me. Without asking my permission and even without telling me. Which, of course, there is no need to do. Now, this Northwest independence movement is not and cannot be a one-man band. It's beginning, people. Finally. After 11 years since my own homecoming, at long last, it's starting to happen. Far too slowly, and frankly, if we don't find some way to kickstart things, then it's going to be too little too late. But it is entirely possible that the dictatorship itself will make some colossal fuck-up that will give us that kickstart. Now, we may not be able to win our freedom, but the dictatorship may lose it. Thanks, guys. Someday you'll get the recognition you deserve. Okay, now I can hear some of you saying, be quiet, Harold. Don't do it. They're really starting to get rattled now, Harold. They're starting to get scared, and a scared tyrant is a dangerous tyrant. If you say anything, you might really piss them off, and we all know that's the secret, right? Say just enough to make a bit of a stir in our wee little movement, but don't cross the line and really piss the people with power off, or they might smush you like a bug. Come on, Harold, remember, discretion is the better part of valor. You really need to keep quiet on this one. Yeah, well, discretion may be the better part of valor, but it's never been quite my style, has it? So what the hell? I guess I'll take another run at getting myself arrested. I have been repeatedly told by everyone from hecklers and Jews and goat dancers on up to genuinely admiring and well-meaning friends and fans that nothing of the kind I describe in my 5 Northwest novels will ever take place. That, as enjoyable as they are, my books are fantasies and they'll never happen. The white man will never rise in revolt against the dictatorship in Washington, D.C., and if he did, it would never work. Wouldn't it work? Could we really never win? Well, maybe not, but let's look at this for a moment. Now, what I'm going to do is simply make some observations on the events of the past few months, which should be pretty obvious to anybody with 2 brain cells to rub together, but which might get me in trouble because I'm the one who's saying them, and I'm saying them to you. Now, this is one of the things about that Bill White case that I can never get any traction on with most of you guys. White's in prison for publishing material on the internet, which was, in fact, a matter of public record, but which he was not allowed to publish or say because of who he was, and also because of who his alleged audience was, i.e. he was allegedly speaking for the benefit of white supremacists, who, by definition, are wicked and violent and evil. Well, not the legal definition. I don't recall any actual federal statute or act of the state legislature stating that anyone with white racial views is to be treated differently by the law, but you know what I mean. And yeah, that's about what the judge in the Bill White case said. Come on, guys, you know what I mean. Everybody knows these white boys are wicked and evil and violent, and Bill White's a neo-Nazi, and therefore the law doesn't apply to them. No, no kidding. That's what he really ruled. A judge in court. He ruled that prosecution can be based not on what you do, but on who you are. So much for equality under the law. So, yeah, it's possible that they'll finally decide to haul me away when I make certain very simple and perfectly obvious comments about the Boston bombing case, which would naturally occur to a 10-year-old. But because I'm the one saying these things and you're the ones listening to them, then somebody's going to end up doing 40 years in a cell next to Edgar Steele. Well, we'll see. Here goes. Let's start with what we know. Four times in the past 4 months, a small number of young men have raised holy hell with the system. Although in one case, it turned out not to be young men, but one mean and crazy middle-aged couple. They've done this by physically striking at the muscle men and the expensive suits who keep the dictatorship in power, and in the final case in Boston by striking publicly at an iconic liberal event in the bluest of all blue states, one with a nigger governor where the private ownership of firearms is all but forbidden outright. I think the psychological effect of the fact that the precious Boston Marathon was hit drove the ruling party far more batshit than the death of a white child did. Now, assuming that 28-year-old Evan Abel did, in fact, whack the Colorado prison commandant, and he's not just a patsy that the police fit into the frame, then three of these people were white. One was black and two were woggish. So this transcends racial lines, which I'm sure should make Chris Matthews happy. Now, we're looking at the effect on our society when individuals lose their fear and when they actually strike at targets from among the genuine progressive and bureaucratic power elite, or in the case of the Boston Marathon, a target that is highly morally significant to the elite. In two cases, that of Christopher Dorner and the two Chechens in Boston, they managed effectively to shut down major American metropoli, sending Los Angeles and Boston into lockdown while the established power structure hurled massive amounts of money and technology as well as huge numbers of weapons and muscle men after one man in one case and two men in the second. Now, in the case of the Texas lawyer rubouts back a few weeks ago when it was believed that there was a serious chance it was done by the Aryan Brotherhood and that these killings might be an act of organized resistance, a senior district attorney in Houston fled into the night in terror, resigning from the AB legal case in fear of his life, which, to even the most dim-witted individual, has to be an indication that if anyone ever did decide to engage in a proactive form of resistance, it would accomplish its goal. Now, we actually made one of those expensive suits turn and run, even if it turned out it wasn't really us, but a corrupt Texas judge and his weird-looking hag of a wife who did it. So, tell me again how a properly planned insurgency, such as I describe in my novels, would never ever work in this country. Judging from their hysterical reactions to one crazy nigger with a few guns and two Chechen muzhiks with a few pressure cookers, I don't see how anybody can deny it's possible, given a proper effort by insurgents who have some balls and some cop on. But, lest I seem to be making a mountain out of four molehills here, let's take a look at the entire state of the nation, which is keeping our people in a state of subservience, and the government of which is plotting our genocide. Never mind the dictatorship itself, let's look at the so-called American people. Suicide has surpassed car crashes as the leading cause of injury death for Americans. Even more disturbing, in the world's largest military, more U.S. soldiers died last year by suicide than in combat. I can't find any racial figure on military suicide rates, but I'd imagine that most of these are white soldiers and servicemen who basically can't handle military discipline and a structured environment, and they find themselves stuck on some godforsaken mountain in Afghanistan or in some cesspit in Yemen with not a shopping mall or a Starbucks in sight, and they can't handle it. Or else they're white female soldiers who joined up because they thought it would be like on the politically correct television shows and in the liberal movies that they were brought up on. One big feminist adventure in which they would show the guys how equal they are. And then they get to Iraq and Afghanistan and find themselves gang raped out back of the mess tent by their black and brown fellow soldiers. I've been unable to obtain any racial figures on military rape either. I imagine the Pentagon keeps such statistics very highly classified, but anyone who grew up in this filthy America knows what the story is there. Fully one-third of the nation's employees suffer what various agencies term chronic debilitating stress. And more than half of all quote-unquote millennials, which is 18 to 33-year-olds, experience a level of stress that keeps them awake at night, including large numbers who are diagnosed with depression or anxiety. Now, the Centers for Disease Control tells us that 1 in 5 of all high school-age children in the United States has been diagnosed with ADHD. And 1 in 5 preteens, that's children aged 6 to 12, have been medically diagnosed with either ADHD, anxiety, depression, or bipolar disorder. I can't find any racial breakdowns on that either, but I'm almost 60 years old, and I remember that in the good old days before integration and immigration and multiculturalism and all that crap, we did not have these problems. No, we didn't. I can't remember running across a single autistic child or ADHD kid during all my 12 years of public school. And so far as these things are real at all, which I question, they are the result of the last 30 years of diversity and politically correct rule. Incredibly, 11% of all Americans aged 12 or older are currently taking SSRI antidepressants. Now, those are in the highly controversial mood-altering psychiatric drugs category, the ones with the FDA's suicide warning label. Those are the ones that show a correlation with shooting spree killers, especially kids who turn out to be school shooters. Women are especially prone to depression, with a stunning 23% of all American women in their 40s and 50s, and that's almost 1 in 4, who are now taking antidepressants, according to a major study by the CDC. Now add to that tens of millions of users of all other types of psychiatric drugs, including, just pick one, the 6.4 million American children between 4 and 17 diagnosed with ADHD and prescribed Ritalin or similar psychostimulants. Now throw in the 28% of American adults with a drinking problem, that's more than 60 million, plus the 22 million who are using illegal drugs like marijuana, cocaine, heroin, and hallucinogens and inhalants, sniffing glue, and pretty soon a picture emerges of a nation of drug takers with hundreds of millions dependent on one toxic substance or another, legal or illegal. Now, getting back to this question of whether or not a serious insurgency by serious people could succeed, I'd say the chances are damn good, again, presuming that the insurgents were capable adults. Now, if we ever did manage to put together an NVA, we'd be fighting against a nation of junkies and crazies who are doped up on meds all the time. A government so corrupt and incompetent they can't even make the planes fly on time or keep the White House open for school tours. And a military so desperate for manpower in a country that dare not conscript an army that they recruit the same drug addicts, mentally ill freaks, criminals, and morons I referred to above to serve as their soldiers. I could say that 12 years ago, 19 young men with box cutters damn near brought the whole house of cards down, but that would start up all the 9/11 conspiracy rants again, so I'll just point out that one nigger with a gun and a couple of crude IEDs sent 2 cities into lockdown and caused the society's ruling class to freak out and run around like chickens with their heads cut off. Now, let's say there were some kind of NVA. 1,000, 2,000 men, more. All acting in organized teams and with a specific, obtainable political goal, not just engaging in random destruction. Now, in view of America's performance over the past 5 months, explain to me once again how it is that we could never win.
evening, comrades. Tonight I'd like to talk to you about a new book that was published in March, and it's called Aradharma, The Way of the Aryan. This is a book about Vedic history. This writer wants to prove that the Vedic gods and that the original Aryans were white, and that they came from an area called Aravarta, which was the capital of the world. But then, as there were population shifts, the group of Aryans that remained white ended up moving to Europe. But the Asian Indians were the ones that maintained the religion the most over time. And so the author is very grateful to all the wonderful Asian Indian missionaries that came to the West to put Vedic culture back in the hands of white. And this author is very glad of that, of course, and is thankful, but says now that Vedic culture is in the hands of whites, once again, that a new golden age will be starting for the next 10,000 years. This author admits that there has been a war on Dharma for the last 2,000 years. So this author is grateful for those that have fought in this war, and he says of all those people, the greatest fighter was a Chakravartin, and a Chakravartin is someone that yields the chakra of Dharma and is a person that combines the qualities of a Kshatriya, which are warlike qualities, and the prayerful qualities of a Brahmin. Now, the greatest Chakravartin of all times was, not surprisingly, Adolf Hitler. And in addition to being a Chakravartin, he was also an Avesha avatar, which is somebody who destroys their own ego and becomes empowered by God. And in addition to that, he was another type of thing. He was a Rakshaka, which is someone who attempts to reverse the effects of the Kali Yuga. So he's a very important individual, and we can pray to him in our desire to bring about Dharmic civilization. Now, this author says that the other people that realized this, even though they were slightly about the type of avatar he was, they thought he was a Purna avatar when really he was an Avesha avatar. And a Purna avatar is someone who is born a divinity. But, of course, the other two that knew this were Savitri Devi and Miguel Sereno. And so they were the others that acknowledged him. In this book, he also talks about the various qualities of Dharmic civilization. So you have a cyclical nature of time, which leads you to the idea that history starts out with a golden age and then degenerates from there and then comes back to a golden age. And he goes on into other various ideas, spirit over materialism, a certain hierarchy of being, class division, various respect of virtues, morality, and values, and the certain ethical absolutes and a non-anthropomorphic view. He goes on to sum up this view as something he calls panentheism, which is not the same as pantheism. It's a certain way of viewing the world. It's a view of God, the soul, and matter, and how these things interrelate. And he talks about the virtues of somebody who would be an advocate of what he calls National Socialism 2.0, in which a person realizes that National Socialism and Sanatana are two wings of the same mighty eagle. And he talks about certain ethical principles that you have to accept, the principles of nonviolence, non-covetousness, clean mind. You can't listen to any rigistic music, for example, and you must have very strict morals. So this is the type of person that he wants to cultivate, and he's setting up a society in the Midwest. It's called the Midwest Vedic Initiative, and he says that he's been talking to God and that the best place to be right now is in the Midwest. Now, like many people that write various mistos, I'm really not sure how this golden age is to come about in a practical sense. But I think that this is a very interesting book. Now, of course, this author would like white people to give up any alternative faiths and return to the dharmic faiths of the white past. Now, he says, of course, that dharma is not just something that we should look at in the past, but we should look at it as an inevitable future. So this author is very optimistic about the revitalization of dharma throughout any place that white people live. And he wants all white people to have this revolutionary book. You can purchase it at lulu.com, and I really think that you should get this book. This is a very important book. I know it's somewhat of a competing location from what Harold is suggesting, but I think it would benefit all white people that are serious about National Socialism, serious about white identity at all, to read this book. The author says that things could get worse, but that would be nightmarish, and so the only alternative is to embrace National Socialism 2.0. And so I would really say please read this book, because it contains a great truth that must be known by all white people. The author says that when this golden age is to come about, there's going to be four delineated classes are going to be enforced in accordance with psychophysical nature. And then there's going to be the construction of a new temple for the white gods, as well as honoring Adolf Hitler. And there's going to be the creation of Germania like Albert Speer envisioned it. And then there's going to be a Medvayana ceremony conducted for the Chakravard and the Emperor of Dharma, which perhaps will be the author of this book, I suppose. So that all sounds very exciting. I'm not sure quite how this will happen, but really I urge you to read this book. And again, the title is Ara Dharma, The Way of the Aryan by Surya Deva. So thank you for listening.
Okay, last week I mentioned that I've been looking for a modern version of the Horst Wessel lead. Several people sent me this. It's not very good, frankly. There's no band, and I don't think the two guys singing it are even German, judging from their pronunciation. But it is the closest thing that I can find to a post-1945 Horst Wessel lead. Anyway, this is from something called Brown Book.
Aber die Eisschollen wurden immer kleiner und schmolzen langsam weg. Und dann ging es immer stromabwärts. Und dann kam da so Stromschnee. Genauso ist das jetzt auch. Man rettet sich von einer Schule zur anderen. Und schließlich ertrinkt man doch.
Yeah.
Right, a couple of deep emails I want to go over here, both from longtime supporters. Sanger Rainsford in Portland writes, Dear HAC, hey, I got a topic I'd be interested in hearing on RFN. I'm being serious, and I would like some deep thought and talking about it. I'm a product of late 20th century America, and I don't seem to grasp a part of traditionalism that I hear getting thrown about by you and by other white nationalist, racialist, whatever authors, and that is how the modern world has introduced moral relativism. What is moral relativism? Why is it bad, and why is it displacing the traditional white culture and worldview? Okay, quick Cliff Notes version, 25 words or less. Moral relativism is the shades of gray in which the Jew hides. Those shades of gray are what make the Jew's survival and prosperity possible. Like any parasite or whatever, he can't live in the light of day. Moral relativism, which is also known as situational ethics, is one of the foundations of liberalism because it allows liberals to change their minds and adapt their worldview and their behavior so that they always win and they always feel good about themselves for winning. For example, they oppose racial discrimination and then affirmative action discriminates like hell against white people in favor of bubble-lipped niggers because in some situations, discrimination is good. In other words, it's not an absolute value. Discrimination against blacks and browns is bad, discrimination against whites is good, therefore that is a relative value. And who gets to determine what those situations are? Why, the lefty liberals, of course, because they are so much wiser and better than we are. Now, you might say that moral relativism is simply a form of hypocrisy, and you'd be right, but the implications are a lot broader and deeper than that. Basically, moral relativism means just what it says, that everything is relative and that there are no moral absolutes. Something that is right in one situation may not be right in another situation, and right and wrong change from day to day as the conditions change. Now, I suppose the ultimate expression of moral relativism might be the old saying that the end justifies the means, and I will now display my own hypocrisy and moral relativism by telling you that that depends on what the end is. And in my opinion, yes, some ends do justify the means, like the survival of the white race. Their moral relativism is always bad because their end is the destruction of the white race and Western civilization, and they mean to kill us all. Our moral relativism is always good because our aim is to preserve that race and civilization. And if we can ever transform our character, we will be killing a lot of them, and that will be a very good thing indeed. How do you like that for an example of moral relativism? The Jews actually invented moral relativism when they created an entire religion with built-in double standards, wherein this elaborate system of pompous and righteous-sounding ethics laid out in the Talmud applies only to other Jews, and it allows the Jews to treat the other 98% of humanity as prey to be hunted and livestock to be milked and sheared for the sustenance of the self-proclaimed chosen of God. Now, liberals did not invent, shall we say, flexible ethics. They merely adapted it from the kikes and layered it with cant and hypocrisy. That's one thing I've always found much more attractive about rightists and fascists and whatnot. We do what we have to do, but we do it with so much less self-serving justification and ethical slithering involved. I should add, we tend to injure, but we don't add insult to injury, if you get my drift. I should add that that doesn't hold for the neocon Judeo-Christian religious right. They're the worst moral vacuums of all because they take what's supposed to be a doctrine of faith and salvation and turn it into a cult worshiping the most evil people on earth and their whole agenda. The first commandment is, "Thou shalt have no other god before me." And these so-called Christians substitute the worship of the Jews for the worship of God and give Israel billions of dollars and the entire U.S. Congress, which shows how good the Jews are at this sort of thing. Now, you remember how Ambrose Bierce defines a Christian as someone who follows the teachings of Jesus Christ insofar as they are not inconsistent with a life of sin? This is the way that Christian Zionists live. A good example is the Ten Commandments in the Bible. Now, if you're religiously inclined, those are pretty clear about what you're not supposed to do. And yet for the past 3,000 or 4,000 years or whatever, people have been not just breaking those commandments, but making up all kinds of incredibly ingenious excuses to break them, and rationales for breaking them, which let themselves off the hook. Now, I've already mentioned how Christian Zionists violate the first commandment by worshiping the Jews instead of God. Another good example is the commandment of "Thou shalt not kill." Now, right now, we have officers in the United States military, genuinely religious men of the buzzcut booyah type, who humbly go to neat, proper Protestant churches with white picket fences on Sundays, with their Barbie doll wives and kids, and who no doubt consider themselves to be genuinely good men, men of faith and virtue of the 700 Club variety. And yet these same men in the past 10 years have slaughtered hundreds of thousands of people, almost all of them innocent non-combatants, including a large number of children, through dropping bombs on them from 30,000 feet in the sky, and lately by dropping high-explosive drones on weddings and elementary schools. Now, these people and children die pretty hideous deaths from being crushed by falling concrete or being burned alive, and yet these buzzcut booyahs feel no remorse and actually a sense of personal satisfaction because they have persuaded themselves that they have done their duty by murdering those children from the sky. And these same men are no doubt genuinely outraged by the death of that one small child in the Boston bombing by Muslims. And they quite honestly do not see any connection or equivalence, even though the child in Boston and the tens of thousands of children in Iraq and Afghanistan are just as dead. Because, you see, we're Americans, and we have the right to kill other people's children if it suits us, but no one has the right to harm ours. In other words, that commandment of "thou shalt not kill" is not absolute. It is relative as to who's doing the killing and who's doing the dying, or, as someone once put it, morality all depends on whose ox is being gored. I'm just using that as an example, and like I said, I myself happen to believe that our own ends really do justify the means. Please don't take that as an attack on Christianity. That's not how it was meant. But this is one reason that, for many centuries, one of the biggest items on the agenda of the Jews and the early liberal secret societies and movements, such as the Illuminati, was to undermine the Christian religion, the real Christian religion that our ancestors practiced. Since the real Christianity which our ancestors practiced is based on absolutes and on the concept of sin. Now, that's really what moral relativism seeks to accomplish. Not so much to eliminate all concept of right and wrong, but to eliminate all concept of wrong, period. In other words, there's just no wrong, but many different shades of right. The Jews and the liberals want to remove the entire concept of sin from human affairs, to create a culture and a politics and a world wherein what is wicked and evil for us to do is all right for them to do. For example, on those rare occasions when we whack a prison commandant or publish certain information on the internet that's available to everybody else with 2 minutes on Google, as in the Bill White case, or when we publish a poem on the internet, as in the case of Johnny Logan Spencer, all the stuff that's wicked and evil and sinful when we do it is perfectly fine for them to do. Because, you see, they're better than us. as when some political gangster in a black robe takes away a father's children and then sends the father to prison for 2 years without trial when he complains about it on the internet, i.e. the Daniel Brewington case. Now, the Jews in the American dictatorship need moral relativism to allow them to tyrannize and do harm to others and feel good about it. And it's not just enough for them to bully and rob and torture others and get their rocks off while doing it. They have to feel good and smug and superior about it while they do so. I think that's the one thing that I find the most sickening about democracy, this smug pretense that these people are so much better than everybody else, when in fact our ruling elite in the Western world are some of the most vicious and evil people in history. Every society and culture has what they call a teo, a system of core beliefs. Now, the Ten Commandments will do for our own civilization, since they're probably our oldest. We do have some others, for example, the Meditations of Marcus Aurelius. But these teos impose moral obligations on men as to what they should do, and perhaps even more importantly, what they should not do. And since selfish people have always wanted to violate these basic principles for their own self-interest, and yet not admit to themselves that that's what they're doing, they came up with moral relativism, which you might call rationalized sin, or sin with an explanation. Now, the Jews have made a religion out of it, and the liberals have made a political ideology out of it. Now, does all of this ramble in the general direction of answering your question, Sanger? Okay, next email comes from Andy Donner over in Seattle. Dear Mr. Covington, I've been going back and forth with military and family of military folks on Facebook, and I'm starting to figure out why they don't seem to express interest in the NF like I always thought they would. It seems as if they and their families have a hard time dealing with the fact that they largely fought for a crock. I've been nicer than this to them, obviously, but they're highly, highly defensive about it. Even when they're racist, kinist, etc., there seems to be some sort of either PTSD-related issue, or we're spitting on hubby, daddy's, whoever's military career if we pose America type issue. Now, have you seen this at all? Yes, frequently. What you have to understand is that a lot of white people join the military for somewhat the same reasons that they later gravitate towards the movement. They're seeking strength, white strength. They're looking for strong white men with the courage to beat back the mud flow, quite literally, and resist all the politically correct horse shit and the tyranny and the filth of the liberal democratic world. They're looking for some place to escape the liberal madness and drugs and degeneracy and lunacy that is Obama's America, where they can find the old ways and the old values. They're looking for a place to hide from Obama in the military. Just as many people come to the Northwest, not to join the revolution or secure the existence of our people and a future for white children, but so they can hide from Obama in a cabin in the Northwoods somewhere. As Randy Weaver and his family learned, that never works out. But a lot of white people believe that the military is the last refuge of the old America, the good America, the white America, that we all seem to have some kind of unconscious genetic memory of in our chromosomes. It's something that we seem to instinctively know once existed and something we've been cheated of. A lot of white men and women and families flee to the military and find temporary physical and financial and moral shelter in a kind of weird Pat Boone time warp. You might say that in certain pockets of the military lifestyle, it's still 1959 and Eisenhower is still president and flying saucers are still landing in the California desert in black and white. The system tends to encourage this to some degree. The military is one of the last places where white males are allowed and even at times encouraged to be physical and brave and proactive, because Obama and the Democrats and all their little Jewish friends need that bravery to defend them against the consequences of their own behavior. It's okay for white boys to set off bombs and shoot people in the military just so long as they let Obama decide who the targets are. I know that was largely the reason that I myself joined the military. It didn't work then, and it's even more appalling now. The military is one of the worst sinkholes of political correctness in American society, especially since Obama authorized buggery in the ranks, and the poor quality of American soldiers, especially in the Army, has become infamous. Now, these last remaining Pat Boone pockets in the military are freakish anachronisms that are only allowed to exist in the world anymore because the power structure still finds them useful. But I suspect that even their time is running out. Now, nobody likes to admit that they've been played for a sucker, which is why so many Americans of the World War II generation, even 30 or 40 years later, would only whisper their realization that we fought on the wrong side, and why these last few white folks in the military world so bitterly cling to their Pat Boone fantasy. Unfortunately, the clock moves forward, never backward. National Socialists like me can never go back to 1939, and red, white, and blue military types can never go back to 1959. It don't work like that. This is Canada's greatest folk singer, the late Stan Rogers.
Cold wind on the harbor and rain on the road. Wet promise of winter brings recourse to coal. There's fire in the blood and a fog on Brador. The giant will rise with the moon. Twas the same ancient fever in the Isles of the Blest that our fathers brought with them when they went west. It's the blood of the Druids that never will rest. The giant will rise with the moon. So crash the glass down, move with the tide. Young friends and old whiskey are burning inside. Crash the glass down, Fingal will rise with the moon. In inclement weather, the people are fey. 3,000 year stories as the night slips away. Remembering Fingal feels not far away. Giant will rise with the moon. The wind's in the north, there'll be new moon tonight, and we have no circle to dance in its sight. Light a torch, bring a bottle, and build the fire bright. The giant will rise with the moon. So crash the glass down, move with the tide. Young friends and old whiskey are burning inside. Crash the glass down, Fingal will rise with the moon. And rain on the road. Wet promise of winter brings recourse to coal. There's fire in the blood and a fog on Brador. The giant will rise with the moon.
Okay, now back to my series of meandering tirades on what Lenin called the conspiratorial method of revolutionary organizing. Now, if you're new to this podcast, please download and listen to the two previous Radio Free Northwests. because I don't feel like going all over this again. Now, judging from some of the feedback I'm getting, some of you still aren't clear on what I mean by the conspiratorial method of revolutionary activism. So what I'm going to do this week, I'm going into Grandpa Simpson mode here, and I'm going to give you folks a little anecdote from my wild and uproarious youth, which will illustrate what I'm talking about as far as the concept of covert white nationalist operations. Now please bear with me, this is going to take a while to explain, but I assure you there is a point, and you will all groove on the ending. Now many years ago, back in Raleigh, before I was openly committed to the Northwest, and when I was between groups, so to speak, I had to exist for months and years at a time on really crappy minimum wage jobs that paid just barely enough to keep a shabby roof of some kind over my head, and a 12-pack in the fridge, and an intermittent newsletter of one title or another going into the mail every month. Now, almost all of these jobs I got through temp agencies, because in those days they didn't do such extensive background checks as they do today. Now, we're talking late 80s and early 90s now, so I was still blacklisted in Raleigh from my NSPA and Greensboro and Attorney General's election period. But the short American attention span had pretty much kicked in, plus the RTP area was growing so fast that a lot of people who were newcomers just had no idea who I was. Now, the Jewish department store owner, who was the local ADL honcho, put my red flag on my credit report, which most regular employers ran on job applicants, but the temp agencies seldom ran Equifax and were so shorthanded in those days that I was usually able to get something through them, enough to bring in $100 a week or so, which was adequate when gas was 60 cents a gallon, and a passably livable one-bedroom apartment was going for $155 a month. Now, there was this one huge corporation, a big outfit in a massive 15-story office building in North Hills, the name of which I think even now it's probably a good idea for me to omit on the wild off chance that this might come back on me somehow. Anyway, this huge multinational used about 80% temp labor so as not to have to provide benefits and health insurance, and they'd take on temps for long-term assignments to the point where you felt like you were permanent there even if you got crap pay and no benefits. Now, virtually all the temp agencies in Raleigh supplied this huge corporation, and again, if memory serves, I think I worked at least 4 long-term assignments in various departments there on and off during the period between about 1987 and 1993 or so. Now, this was a cubicle gig where I had to wear slacks, no jeans, a shirt with a closed collar, and a tie, but other than that, it wasn't bad. The work itself was okay, if you don't mind bureaucracy. At least it wasn't in insurance. I did that for about a year and a half, and my God, have you ever tried to sit down and actually think about insurance? It rots the mind. Anyway, this big corporation did something I won't get into, but which required the careful assembling of a lot of very complex legal and technical documents, bringing all these documents together in a big act of ritual bureaucracy, and transforming it all into a big widget that made oodles and oodles of money for the stockholders and the big executives, who were all a bunch of buzzcut Southern Baptist 700 Club types. I'm sure there were Jews around, but they kept a low profile. As is very common in these situations, this company employed a lot of black females because they're affirmative action twofers, being both black and female. And a black lesbian, of course, is the greatest prize of all because she's a threefer, filling not one, not two, but three, count them, three affirmative action quotas. Now, these creatures also got bumped to the head of the line when the openings for actual vested hires became vacant, of course. So what you had in most departments was these dolled up to the nines, perfumed negresses with straightened hair supervising young white female temps. Now, the company below department level was about 90% female with a few token white boys like me and one black male who was basically there because they knew they had to have one somewhere. But they never hired anymore because this job did require some intelligence. And it was possible to screw things up and lose the company money if you put some stupid nigger in charge of certain things. Now, the one nigger male we had I ever worked with was basically responsible for packing and sending out airborne express letters, and I seem to recall that he screwed the pooch on that a couple of times. There was also one department which somehow got taken over by faggots. I'm not sure how that happened, but as near as I could figure, it was predictable. One bugger boy came in as a temp, managed to get hired on as vested, meaning an actual company employee. He worked his way up into a supervisory position, and then he started hiring other bugger boys hand over fist until the whole department smelled like juicy fruit and Vaseline. Okay, now, are you guys in the picture? Again, I apologize for the length of time it's taking me to set this up, but you need to understand how things were if you're going to appreciate my little conspiratorial method anecdote. Okay. In the department where I worked for the longest at this company was a negress whom I will call Deborah, which is not her real name, and whom I will admit was the model for the character of Gabrielle Martine in Freedom's Sons. Now, if you've read my description of Gabby in that book, you will know Deborah. Anyway, this woman would make occasional snide and nasty remarks to me, but she never really tried to mau-mau me. With one exception, when I was very young, I've never had any problem with niggers trying to mau-mau me in the workplace, probably because it's harder for them to work up a gang situation where there's five of them to one white man. But Deborah was just unbelievably cruel to the white women she had working under her at this company. And not so much even the temps, whom she could fire at will, but that was a two-way street. The temp girl could also call up her company and request a new assignment. And this happened so often that Deborah apparently got called up to the boardroom or whatever and told to lay off the temps because they couldn't keep any in that department otherwise. So she targeted for abuse the three or four white women she had working for her who were the vested employees and therefore pretty much at her mercy for performance reviews and who she could get actually fired for real, not just transferred out. I won't get into details because this story is already running way too long, but for some months I watched this Sheboon do everything she could to try and reduce these other girls to madness and despair, and I say girls because they were all in their very early 20s, which to me at that time was a girl. Any of you who have ever worked in a bad office situation probably understand what I'm talking about. Verbal abuse, constantly arbitrary, stupid orders and decisions that went bad, and then Deborah's stupidity got blamed on the white girls, since obviously we can't blame the black affirmative action supervisor. There was constant contempt and belittlement, a lot of shouting and screaming, petty insistence on following the most minor rules and achieving perfection, even when it keeps some mother with a child in the office until 9 o'clock at night. There was the nasty gossip and the little giggling, needling crap. You guys, I'm sure, understand. Just everything ugly and vicious and nasty. She was obviously tormenting these girls for sport and out of pure racial malice because they had the one thing that she could never have, which was a white skin. And everybody on the floor knew about it, just as they knew that there was not a damn thing that anyone could or would do about it. There was this one young woman there that I had a liking for, and it was practically a daily routine for this black animal to reduce this girl to fleeing to the bathroom in tears. Now, she wasn't my girlfriend or anything like that, don't get me wrong, but I'm just one of these 19th century dinosaurs who gets filled with rage when I see a child or a woman being hurt, and I noticed. Now, I think most of us have at one time been forced to try and function in a really bad work environment of this kind, more and more as the situation in the country has become worse and worse. So we all have some idea what I'm talking about here. Like everyone else, I watched and I saw, and I remembered. But I did nothing for the same excuse that the rest of them did nothing. Because I needed the job and I understood that making a stand would make me unemployable and bring up my past, and I could do nothing and help no one if I was living under a bridge. Now, I'm mentioning this so that I can let you guys out there know that I get it. I understand that not everybody can jump up on a table in the break room and start haranguing the crowd. Not everybody can get his face on the 6 o'clock news. Not everybody can make a public issue out of his racial views, that you have to exercise some kind of discretion or else you won't be able to function in society. I understand this because I've had to do it myself. I had to do it for many years. So let's just, you know, I'll be clear on that. Okay, let's set the scene to the summer of 1993. Yeah, I think that's it. I have lost my last office job at this big North Hills company after one of my Secret Service visits due to my actions after Waco, which we won't get into, another story. And I've been pretty much blacklisted there, since having the secret police show up and drag you down to human resources is not exactly the best recommendation for even a temporary employee in a major American corporation. Anyway, so I am now back at the company as a contract security guard, working for one of these little private security companies. I'm on the night shift. I'm watching my former co-workers come in the morning, not one of whom recognizes me. Now, the whites, because they were almost all temps, who are also gone by now. And none of the niggers recognize me without my beard, because us Ofays all look alike. I come in at midnight, and I basically spend the night wandering the empty building alone, guarding it from the forces of evil. There are security cameras, including hidden fiber optic cameras to spy on the employees, but Guess who's in charge of those cameras at night? Okay, are you guys beginning to see where I'm going with this? A long and complex story short, in order for this company to do what it does and make oodles and oodles of money for buzzcut Baptist assholes with American flags in their lapels, representatives from each department must periodically appear in a room together, produce sheafs of complex, hard-to-assemble, and almost impossible-to-replace legal and technical documents, and then they have to pile these documents on a table. They take off all their clothes and dance around it, chanting magical rituals with smoky torches and ritual lashing of blood from flint ritual knives and blah, blah, blah. A lot of feathers in there somewhere. And then huge piles of cash appear on the table in place of the documents. Okay, that's a little exaggerated, but you get the idea. If even one of those documents should be late, or out of order, or even, God help us, missing, then all holy hell will break loose and someone's neck is going under the guillotine. Now, this situation involves the jeopardizing of so much money that affirmative action and political correctness concerns no longer apply. Remember that, all of you. Large amounts of money cancel out political correctness. About the only thing that can. Now, the more money involved, the less the wealthy white men and the Jews in suits who really run things in this country care about political correctness. Now, I not only had unfettered access to the building and security system at night, including Deborah's cubicle, but I was a former employee who understood how the company's business and system worked. I could read the file routers and the schedule, and I knew exactly what documents had to be where and when and what would happen if they weren't. I also have a very long memory for baboons who make young girls cry. Now, at this point, I will draw a discreet veil over subsequent events, but suffice it to say that by the time I left that job to move on to the weird computer company in Cary, which is another story, Deborah no longer worked at that company. Now, to this day, she probably doesn't know what happened or why. The why I can help her with. It is because she is an animal who once dared to make a beautiful young woman of my race cry. And some higher power decided that enough was enough, at least this once, and gave the opportunity to avenge that girl's pain to one of the rare white men remaining on Earth who would dare to use it, to strike a blow against the beasts of the field who have become our masters. Yeah, I know, it was sneaky and underhanded, and nothing like the NVA tickles in my novels, but this is the real world. And in the real world, terrorism and deception are the weapons of the weak against the strong. This was not the way that I would have, or probably should have, avenged the outrages that this nignog committed. But we're not allowed to avenge such horrors in the way that we should anymore. So it was that or nothing. It was the only way open to me, and I took it. Now, do you want an example of what I mean by the conspiratorial method? That's it. This is Elvis Costello.
Well, you know your time has come, and you're sorry for what you've done. You should have never been playing with a gun in those complicated shadows. Well, there's a line that you must toe, and it'll soon be time to go. But it's darker than you know in those complicated shadows. All you gangsters and rude clowns who were shooting up the town when you should have found someone to put the blame on. Though the fury is hot and hard, I still see that cold graveyard. There's a solitary storm that's got your name on. You don't have but I know what I speak. You think you're like iron steel, but iron steel will bend and break in those complicated shadows. Sometimes justice you will find is just dumb, not colorblind. And your poor shattered mind can't take it all in. All those phantoms and those shades should jump up on judgment day and say to the Almighty, I'm still thinking I've sinned. But then Joe, who was dismissed, took his neck and gave it a twist. So you see, you won't be missed in those complicated shadows. You can't say just what you like in a voice like a John Ford film. Take the law into your hands. You will soon get tired of killing in those complicated shadows. Complicated shadows. Complicated shadows. Complicated shadows.
I'm going to try and address an issue with the conspiratorial method here, which is difficult because it's hard for both the people who ask me questions on it and also for me to put this into words. Now, I know what these people are asking and I know how to answer it, but it's a very difficult concept to formulate for Americans because it's so European. And that is the idea of being covert and yet everyone who needs to know knowing who you are. Some of you have accused me of contradicting myself by talking about covert John le Carré-style lifestyles while simultaneously telling people to step forward and get cracking. I can see how it might look that way. It's the old debate, security versus effectiveness. Now, my standard response is that the difference between security consciousness and paranoia is that security consciousness helps you accomplish your mission while remaining free, while paranoia prevents you from accomplishing your mission and eventually takes you out of the game just as effectively as a prison cell would. There are those who say that a revolutionary can't be effective if he steps too far forward and he makes himself a target for victimization by the dictatorship and ends up in prison. Okay, now that's true, but if you step too far back in the shadows so that you're actually doing nothing, which is what Americans tend to do, then the end result is the same. Nothing changes and the tyrant continues to tyrannize and murder. Now, if we are all too timid and frightened to do anything at all, there will be no change until the dictatorship literally, physically crumbles away and the prison guards wander off because they haven't been paid, and the prisoners either break through the fence or else they starve and cannibalize one another if they're on lockdown when the guards leave. That kind of thing. Now, you have to bear in mind that the whole point of what we are doing is to change the world in a certain way, specifically to secure the existence of our people and the future for white children through the creation of a sovereign and independent white homeland here in the Pacific Northwest. Okay, let me boil this down for you as best I can. Now, first off, this applies only to people who are resident in the homeland. If you're not resident in the homeland, then, to be honest, except in a very tiny number of very skilled exceptions, it doesn't really matter what you do. You're never going to accomplish anything for the cause because you're offsides and out of position. Now, here in the homeland, here is the ideal situation that you should shoot for. Everybody, or at least everybody white, in your workplace and your neighborhood and your personal circle should know that you are the local racist and the local go-to guy for Northwest independence. Everybody except the police and the FBI, of course. Now, the FBI and Department of Homeland Security will inevitably know about you because they intercept and archive all email in this country and squirrel it away in that big cave in West Virginia, which I imagine by now looks like something out of the X-Files. And inevitably, your email will be cross-referenced with mine and other racialists you've been in contact with. You simply have to accept this. You make sure that you never send anything by email that you wouldn't want read out in open court, and you drive on, because it's impossible to do otherwise in the early 21st century. But remember, just because they intercept and steal everybody's emails doesn't mean they have the manpower to sit and read them all. Now, by staying calm and keeping your Northwest independence activities on the down low, you keep yourself sufficiently low on the radar so that the secret police consider you to be just another file in a very, very large database. Now remember, just because the regime can create a surveillance state doesn't mean that they can create an efficient surveillance state. Now think of the magnitude of the task of trying to track and analyze and spy on everybody in this country who has ever uttered a single criticism of Barack Obama or used the word nigger in an email. It simply isn't possible for anyone to stay off their radar if they even gripe on the internet. The regime's packet-sniffing software will find you out. Now, the trick is to make sure that you don't stand out in a very, very large sea of dissidents. Right-wing, left-wing, racist, communist, black, homo, green, what have you. Yeah, they've got all your emails since 2001, but who are they going to get to read and analyze them all? Your case file is probably backed up in the queue until the year 2023. Now, another way that you keep low on the dictatorship's radar is by doing your work the old-fashioned way, in person, face-to-face, or else by postal mail. Now, my guess is some of these young FBI agents and postal inspectors who don't remember the J. Edgar days don't even remember how to do a mail cover. They're so used to sitting in those cubes, tapping away on those keyboards. Now, the time will come when the party will need actual public spokesmen to do media interviews, once the blackout lifts for whatever reason. Now, when that time comes, you may or may not end up among those whose face appears on the 6 o'clock news. Now, if that's the way it plays out, then accept your destiny and drive on. Don't court publicity, but don't shun it either. Make sure of who you're speaking to, and then speak your mind, and if something bad results, then accept it as the price tag for doing what's right. Yes, you have to keep yourself functional in society. Neither I nor anyone is asking you to do anything stupid that will get you defunctionalized. But you must do something, something effective and serious that will eventually help lead to change. Don't hide away in the shadows, waiting for some big, huge crisis to hand you an opportunity. Make at least one opportunity every day to do something for the Northwest Republic. A few men by themselves can inflict any more than a pinprick on this huge and evil beast. But a million pinpricks put together will bleed him to death. And yes, I know that all this sounds like nothing but a string of cliches. That's all I can lay on you sometimes in view of who's listening. But remember, cliches get that way because they're true. Our time is up now, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington 98104, or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.